Do you ever worry that the crap that you watch online is actively making you dumber? Like, you're watching people debate political ideas and you convince yourself that you're learning, but you know that in actuality, your brain is starting to decompose, or at least it feels that way.
I don't work for you, Soy Pill. I don't have to answer questions to your satisfaction.
Yeah, well, you also have answer the memory, sorry. So
hold on. I'm going to have to start meeting people.
Well, it turns out this might actually be true. You know, the isolating effect of online communication is turning us into more reactive, paranoid, and frankly, dumb people. At least according to this book, Don't Talk About Politics, written by the political theorist Sarah Stein Lebrano. Now, in this book, Lebrano argues that the culture of online political debate isn't doing anything to change minds or make the world a better place. And it's all being fueled by a loneliness epidemic that is very much happening on purpose, with a lack of infrastructure and community that's turning us all into weird little guys yelling at the computer all day. So on this month's edition of Burns After Reading, I'm going to talk about why we need to stop talking about politics if we actually want to become more politically effective. Unless this is your first time on the internet, you're well aware that one of the most popular forms of content is videos of people getting owned or destroyed or dog walked or annihilated in debate.
You don't want to be in permanent poverty in the United States. Finish high school, get a job, don't have babies until you're married. Those three things, you won't be in permanent poverty in the United States.
And if this is your first time on the internet, immediately close your device, throw it in a river, and just run. Just run. You'll thank me later, I promise. And this culture isn't confined to the computer. You know, Charlie Kirk was killed in the middle of debating college students about some very, very important stuff. It was important work that he was doing when it was, I'm not saying anything else about this.
Should it be legal if a mom finds out she's having a girl?
Okay.
But she wants a boy. Should she be able to abort that 3-week-old?
Now, while Kirk has become a martyr of sorts, with his statue being built on at least one college campus that I know of, his legacy seems to have less to do with using debate to change minds and more to do with establishing debate as a permanent feature of online and increasingly in-person political culture. And of course, something that's really shaped the content ecosystem. And it's not just a right-wing issue, as we see this same form of content in left-leaning media as well. Now, it's here where Sarah Stein Lebrano's analysis picks up an important thread, as she clarifies one of the major myths that we've used to convince ourselves that debate is useful as an end in itself. She writes that, "The myth suggests that as long as the public is continuously exposed to ideas and can discuss them, politics will more or less function well. All you have to do is browse the available options and purchase the right one. It is a kind of consumerism. It is reasoning as commerce. In this marketplace of ideas, we are meant to believe that all ideas are equally worthy of debate and that the best and most rational ideas will rise to the top. Much like how the free market determines which products are most desirable based on consumer demand, the marketplace of ideas implies that we're both able to identify the best ideas available and then change our minds accordingly. But as Lebrano explains, often what's happening is that we are seeking out ideas that confirm our pre-existing worldviews. And it's very uncommon that public political debate are actually going to change our minds. Have you ever had your mind changed by a debate? I would genuinely like to hear about it, so please let me know in the comments. Now, we all know that the anger and outrage created by debate culture is so lucrative because it doesn't just perpetuate ideology, it makes people money. Because the more we're online complaining and commenting and watching people yelling, the more of our data is getting out there, helping all types of weirdos monetize our attention. And the worst of these weirdos are the ones buying and selling our data to track us, sell us crap we don't need, and even exploit us. And sadly, this affects all of us because all of our personal data is increasingly just everywhere on the internet. And the number of data breaches which make our data vulnerable to some very uncool dudes is rising every year. According to the annual data breach report by the Identity Theft Resource Center, it went up by 211% from 2023 to 2024, due mainly to 5 mega breaches. And this is why I'm so glad I started using this video sponsor, Incogni. Incogni tracks down and removes your data from multiple websites, including online directories, people search sites, and commercial databases. The process is fully automated for hundreds of known data brokers, i.e. companies that collect and sell your data without your consent. And because data can reappear on these sites, Incogni repeatedly removes it for you. They also have a custom removal feature to take down almost everything exposed about you online. All you do is you send them a link, and then your dedicated privacy expert handles it for you. This all helps reduce the risk of scams, protects your online and offline privacy, and helps you take back control of your personal data so you know where it is and how it's being used. This is something I used to not really care about, but after some debate warrior guys got mad at me and started sending me really creepy stuff, it made me much more aware of how much of my information was out there and why I wanted to keep it as private as possible. So if you want to protect yourself from data brokers, online criminals, and weird little debate guys, check out Incogni today. It's super easy. All you do is create an account and share a bare minimum of information that they can use to track down your profiles online. Then you authorize Incogni to legally contact hundreds of brokers on your behalf. They'll then remove your information from data brokers on their list and any site that you send them with their custom removal feature. Now, whether they're using personal data to track you down or your social security number to take out loans or healthcare companies using your data to raise your premiums, how gross is that? There are lots of potentially unfun outcomes of having your personal data all over the internet. And this all feels more urgent at a time when people are being tracked down for expressing political views that the weird little guys don't like, leading to harassment and even people getting fired from their jobs. Now, I started using Incogni last fall, and so far they've completed 443 removal requests for me, with 22 more currently in progress. And they did all this while I was just, you know, hanging out. Join me in taking your personal data back with Incogni. Use the code BURNS at the link below to get 60% off your annual plan, or go to incogni.com/burns. And thank you so much to Incogni for sponsoring a video that's about a book. That's pretty cool that they did that. Even more troubling, the culture of debate and the marketplace of ideas makes it really easy for batshit insane ideas to present themselves as worthy of serious consideration.
I think you say I'm a fascist.
Yeah, I am.
Lobrano writes, debate can not only make two unequal sides appear equal, but they can also make the center, or whatever position lies between these artificial poles, appear to be common sense and the obvious solution even when it isn't. So debates between right-wing authoritarianism and socialism inherently posit that the liberal free market system is a sort of natural middle ground between the two.
The work of politics, of bridging over a lot of profound, fundamental moral disagreements, I think became somewhat demeaned, diminished. It began to seem like, in many cases, a betrayal to people. The tent shrunk.
You know, in this Jubilee episode, watched by 32 million people, scientists and flat earthers attempt to find a sort of middle ground between the consensus of scientific research and unscientific conspiracy theory.
Once you start to really look, take a hard look at the evidence, and you are unafraid of just standing for the truth, wherever that may lead you, people end up becoming flat earthers.
When everything is worth debating, then every idea becomes worthy of being taken seriously. Sort of like if you stop to get a drink at the grocery store, and then the Gatorade you wanted shared a cooler with bottles of horse piss. Because simply by being on offer, on sale, at the same place that the Gatorade is on sale, that bottle of horse piss is somehow legitimized. Also, don't drink horse piss. Right after I wrote that line, I Googled drinking horse urine and health or something like that to see if it's actually a thing. And my friends, let me tell you, it is, because that's the world that we get to live in.
Is a product called Primarin. And the name Primarin is a shortened form of the phrase pregnant mare urine.
But this critique isn't just aimed at the various horse piss salesmen of the online political space. It also applies to earnest leftist attempts to change the world via the explanation of ideas. Lobrano writes that many left-leaning people feel discouraged hearing about all this because they harbor the hope, sometimes only half-consciously, that if they just explain oppression clearly enough, people will be motivated to overthrow it. And as a former academic and current whatever all this is, this shit hits me really hard because I've spent so much of my adult life trying to critically explain systems of power and oppression in the hopes that this would lead to some type of material change. You know, the idea that if we just understood the world a certain way, we would all wake up and make the world different. I'm confident that at least 20% of you just thought of Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach, where he writes that the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. If you're one of those 20%, let me know. Now, Lobrano points out how the culture of internet debate and discussion has been so skilled at not only tricking us into thinking that our constant talking about ideas equates to some sort of action, but also that in monetizing this process, it keeps us consuming and creating content while the world burns. You know, it's almost like all of this is on purpose. Okay, let me pivot for just 1 second to talk about another 19th century thinker who can help us think through this current cultural disaster, none other than my guy, Soren Kierkegaard. Now, he critiqued 19th century culture for its emphasis on reflection, you know, thinking about the world, which he thought distracted people from decision and action, you know, actually doing things in the world. It's a similar energy to Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach, you know, too much philosophy leads to not enough social and political action. And Kierkegaard thought that this problem was exacerbated by the popular media of his day, namely newspapers and gossip magazines, which created more opportunity than ever to consume information about what was happening in the world, leading to a feeling that reading about the revolutionary actions of others was somehow a radical act in itself. I've been there. I've been guilty of that. I've watched like a documentary on revolutionary stuff and thought, yeah, We're doing it by watching a movie. It's on a streaming platform. It's owned by a billionaire who's a fascist. You know, the point here wasn't to draw a line between thought and action, but to emphasize in a similar vein to Marx that reflecting on the world is useful in as much as it leads to decision and action within the world. The problem is that when reflection becomes an end in itself, you know, especially when it comes to politics. And I think that this Kierkegaardian context can help us better understand the stakes when Lobrano writes that we need to stop thinking that talking about politics is the same thing as truly engaging in it. Because all the evidence suggests that simply presenting one another with ideas changes very little. Instead, doing politics means taking new actions and building relationships. Put simply, if we want to change minds, we need to do stuff, ideally with other people and definitely away from the computer. But this is hard to do when the internet is making us increasingly addicted to platforms that are at the same time making us more isolated and less likely to engage with others in an open and collaborative way. Lobrano writes about the phenomenon of social atrophy, which describes the weakening through disuse of the neural networks that help us navigate the social world. She references studies that show how isolation leads to a loss of cognitive function in humans, making us worse at emotional regulation, reasoning, and memory. Basically, our brain is well prepared to relate to other people, and when we do, our brain gets exercised by utilizing its full operational complexity. But when we live alienated lives, devoid of community and social interaction, our brain quite literally atrophies. It's like the brain is a muscle, and we have not hit the gym in quite some time. The consequences of all of this are scary. Lobrano notes that reduced social contact literally decreases the volume in key areas of our brain. Now, one effect of this is that lonely individuals are more anxious, angry, and negative and less positive, optimistic, comfortable, and secure than socially embedded individuals. Or to put it in the terms that make sense to those of us who had to stop taking science classes in high school, being chronically isolated causes a certain kind of, well, brain damage. Lobrano points out not just how estrangement from others leads to changes in personality, but also how socially isolated individuals underestimate the opportunities available for them to connect with others and fail to see what they should be doing to build and maintain relationships. Moreover, social isolation appears to make people more emotionally volatile and easily upset, especially in social situations. And this makes sense of why so many young men who are caught up in online debate culture sometimes act like absolute nutbags. And Lobrano notes this is also a class issue, as isolation and alienation strike the poor worst of all. Being broke makes you more isolated and lonely. Loneliness screws with your brain and your sense of self, and all of this sets you up to get caught up in the culture of intellectual war that dominates so much political media. One of the most toxic outcomes of all of this is that it creates a type of aggressive person who is always wearing conflict-colored glasses. This means that they see aggression and then create conflict where there isn't any. Their societal alienation leads to alienating others in a super unchill and self-perpetuating cycle. Lobrano writes that we need to stop framing problems and letting governments and institutions frame problems as loneliness, since what is really at stake is a collective problem about estrangement and alienation, not an individual problem or feeling. We've created the structural conditions for large groups of lonely and alienated people to fall into the belief that participating in debate culture is doing something politically urgent and even meaningful. At the same time, these conditions incentivize a type of professional debate guy culture, where individuals capitalize on this loneliness and anger to build their own brands and create armies of digital sycophants, many of whom use literal war metaphors to describe what they're doing when they're just cyberbullying people. So what we need in response to this is not only to reclaim and rebuild social infrastructure, something that Lebrano talks about at length in the book.
I know there are some who view this administration with distrust or disdain, or who see politics as permanently broken. And while only action can change minds, I promise you this. If you are a New Yorker, I am your mayor.
Not just to stop thinking and start doing things, but to do all of this collectively and with a spirit of friendship. And this spirit of friendship is a crucial corrective to the combative political culture that encourages us to constantly be seeking out new enemies. And while Lebrano does recommend joining protest movements as a corrective to our culture of digital debate and reflection, it's not because these actions have a direct political effect. They very often don't, but because they can both change minds and develop a spirit of community and political friendship. She writes that, interestingly, those who become members of protest movements compared with control groups of similar people who don't seem to have greater self-esteem and well-being. So if dogpiling on your least favorite digital political pundit leaves you feeling more angry and alone, well, going to a protest or joining a political movement makes you happy, and happy people don't shoot their husbands. More importantly, in engaging with social and political movements of all sizes and scales, whether it is protesting against the increasingly psychotic military actions of your country or organizing tenants in your apartment building, we're not just doing stuff, we're putting thought into action and often learning as we go. Lebrano writes that one of the reasons why action is so central to political thinking is that it is only in trying to change the world that we discovered how it works. This touches back on the critiques of Marx and Kierkegaard that I already talked about. These guys, in different ways, both emphasized that our thought needs to be oriented towards action, and that our action needs to then facilitate further thinking, which then leads to more effective action, which leads back to more thought, and on and on and on and on and on, until we win. For Lebrano, to think effectively about politics, then, is not only to think about action. It is also, by necessity, to take action. Good political reasoning cannot happen simply by reading and debating, because there are some things we can only learn through our attempts to change the world. Certain kinds of knowledge are better achieved through action than reflection. You know, action shapes who we are. The communities and movements that we participate in shape our political subjectivity. And if you don't actively form your own subjectivity via the means of concerted and collective action, well, there's a host of reactive apps and digital communities that would gladly passively form your subjectivity for you. Not making a decision is, in this case, still making a decision. Okay, so there's a lot more than that going on in this book. I really, really do recommend checking this one out for yourself. It's both accessible to those without a heavy background in theory, while being plenty engaging for the sicko theory heads among us. Now, I always recommend starting with your local library, but if you're a real sicko like me and need to write notes all over your book, consider using the affiliate link below to grab a copy from bookshop.org. In doing so, you're going to be supporting independent bookstores and not Jeff Bezos. Okay, I want to quickly conclude with a couple of Lebrano's recommendations from the final sections of the book. Now, the first is a call for those of us involved in the creation of political media. You know, whether that be YouTube videos, TikTok explainers, video game streams where you also talk about theory and politics. She writes that we should try to create media that helps people with the difficulty of reasoning so that they are able to think through the gray areas rather than rushing to find a way out of the discomfort. Our highly conflict-driven formats for discussion, from radio shows to Twitter algorithms, disengage those who don't like conflict and trap those who can just about stand it in cycles of thinking about it more or less as war. Now, we know that conflicts and negative emotions lead to increased clicks and engagement, so we need to challenge ourselves to avoid that temptation in both our creation and consumption of digital media. And don't get me wrong, like every time I put out a video, I get stressed trying to make titles and thumbnails that you guys will click without being too clickbaity, because then you get mad at that as well. You know, and it's always hard to not use our social media as a platform simply for dunking on our ideological political enemies or making jokes about bad guys, which again, I like doing and is fun and once got me banned from Twitter. Lobrano concludes her book with a general call for all of us who believe that ideas are important and who think that good ideas can even change the world. She writes, there are at least two ways to love ideas, to talk about them and to live them in the world. My fellow lovers of ideas, the beauty of re-understanding politics in the way I suggest here is that it is still possible to believe in ideas. Ideas do matter, but they matter through our actions and relationships. And that is a hopeful thing. So let us try to go out and live out our ideas in a relationship with other people. And let's try to build a world where it's easier for everyone to do this, because that's what it means to truly think about politics. Thank you so much to Sarah Stein Lobrano for writing this book. Thank you to my patrons for making this channel possible. Now, if you like this sort of thing and want to dive deeper into philosophical and political ideas, all while helping us keep doing this work, then consider joining my Patreon community. I'm about to launch a new learning community called Burns Theory, and I would love to have you be a part of it. It's my attempt to fight against the alienating effects of the digital world and create a place where we can learn and ask questions in a spirit of friendship, not one of conflict. So hopefully I see you there, and I'll see you here for the next one.